Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Benjamin Richardson.
Hello.
And Rich Hudson.
Hello.
So a couple of things are worth talking about this week. We've got a whole bunch of stuff in regards to Sekiro and difficulty and all that type fun. But for now, what do you guys think of the BAFTAs?
I love the BAFTAs.
Me too. I thought it was brilliant.
I'm a really, really big fan. I know I was saying before the pod that the Game Awards are great. Mm-hmm. But that seemed more focused on entertainment rather than appreciation. I mean, obviously it does both, but the BAFTAs, you know, everybody comes, black tie, very formalised. Mm. It's like a real night.
It's what you'd expect for an actual awards night.
Exactly.
Yeah. So. I just, one of the things that I loved was just, because I watched the whole thing, it's like a 3.5 hour, like in entirety, there's a whole pre-show thing where they had Effie Wilson from Eurogamer. Just sort of doing a thing, like talking to different people on the red carpet or whatever, and Dara O'Brien, Ed Byrne, they had like Lucas Pope was there, and it just immediately there's a feeling of genuine care and like appreciation for
Charlie
gaming.
Brooker.
Yeah, my boy Charlie Brooker, who's somebody great. Who also gives an absolute like crap about games. Yeah. If you listen to his Desert Island Discs on Radio 4, one of his discs was a game soundtrack. I can't remember what it was. Specifically, well, it was like a really, really old game.
Right.
It was like, this is one of my Desert Island discs.
It was
like
he was a games journalist.
Legitimizes
the event again.
Mm-hmm. But it's like that whole thing of just sort of like raising up the bar. Like people like us who've played games all our lives have known that there are worthwhile stories and, you know, just so much worthwhile qualities to gaming that like just don't get their
just as an art form.
Yeah, as an art form, they just don't get their just due, and it's about time kind of thing.
Another thing I'll say as well, it's such a wholesome ceremony where all the industry is there to congratulate one another. Mm-hmm. It's not competitive.
Well, exactly. Back to the Game Awards this year or last year, Jeff Keighley opened it with with Reggie.
Phil Spencer
and what's his face from PlayStation. And he brought them all out together and they were just like, we're here to celebrate games. Like, yes, like everyone would think we all hate each other, but no, we don't.
That was one of the things that Dara O'Brien was just like, you know, if you're a fan of these people's work, then show your love, like clap, celebrate, cheer, whatever. And that just led to a really great vibe across the whole thing. And I thought that one of the things that they pulled off was just there's a lot of really good, worthwhile social messaging in there that like in a bunch of different award ceremonies can come off as cringe. But like all the people here really believe what they're saying. And I thought that, you know, whether it be like even at the end, Corey Barlog's speech about why creativity is worthwhile and respecting other people to like the smallest little mobile titles like Mad Child Lebensborn and the devs that made that telling their story when they got their award. Like, I loved all that stuff.
Well, this is another thing as well. I think it treats every single aspect of the game medium evenly, like from mobile to multiplayer to MMOs and, you know, big budget single player games. Everything is treated with the same degree of respect. It's not like, here's your best foreign language award, which is just shoved to the side.
Yeah, true. We can dive into a little bit of one of the weirdest things, which was that Red Dead 2 didn't win a damn thing. Neither did Celeste.
No,
I think it's because there's always that comparison to the Game Awards. Like, we have like the film BAFTAs always compared to the Oscars. Mm. We have the TV BAFTAs compared to, what is it, Golden Globes and Emmys.
Yeah.
Like, I think there is that because obviously Red Dead came out with a lot of stuff from the Game Awards.
Yes.
But yeah,
and also,
last night.
It doesn't mean that Red Dead got the short shrift because it was nominated for 6 awards.
Yes.
It's just the bar. It was very dramatic.
One of the things from with this, like the general level of respect that was across the whole ceremony, did for the first time when I've ever watched an awards ceremony make me think that even the nominations were just as good as winning. Like they sort of really got that across.
Yeah.
Which hardly any sort of big budget media ceremonies get that across. That actually just to be there nominated is a win in
itself.
That's
one of the problems with awards in general is that effectively you're saying this is better than all the rest, which is not necessarily the case, but as long as you're doing it, something has to win. It has to be a focal point. You can't just say, here's a load of good games.
Yeah. So we can break down some specific things. And we might as well start with the biggest one, which was actually best game went to God of War, which is like, for me, that's absolutely, I adore God of War every single second of it. So I was just glad to see the whole cast get back up there again. But it was up against Celeste, Red Dead 2. I think Astrobot was in there as well. Yeah. Did you guys see God of War coming, or did you expect something more like a Red Dead?
I think it was kind of given to be God of War, because obviously God of War took...
It swept everything
took
else.
The Game Awards, took the Game of the Year from the Game Awards as well, mm-hmm. and it won a lot of other stuff as well. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, I think it would have done... I mean, I was expecting it kind of to be like the Game Awards, where like Red Dead 2 won a load of stuff, but then God of War won the big one.
Yeah.
And then obviously God of War won a lot of stuff here, and you could have thought, oh, it would go to Red Dead instead, but no, it still went to God of War. So yeah. I think it deserves it, absolutely.
Yeah. I wasn't surprised in the slightest. I mean, right. what was very heartening is Corey Barlog again. The emotion he displayed despite winning at the Game Awards and despite all the accolades he said, it still means just as much to him.
He's such a good dude.
He's so lovely.
Like a great spokesperson for the industry.
So heartfelt, yeah.
And for creativity and just like, yeah, like why they do what they do. And just like, he really grounds it as just being like, I'm just a person creating. And
if he's an advert for why you should get into the games industry, you know, if you've been feeling jaded or disenfranchised by the
EAs and the Activisions and the corporate side.
You just look at someone like him, you say, look, their passion's still there. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of passion, Mr. Joseph Farris was there, my favourite man. Rich is also a huge fan.
Oh, I love watching him just make an absolute ass of himself. And I just sit there and think, why am I watching this?
So there's two offs to this. This point is that he won, A Way Out won Best Multiplayer, which we'll get back to. But also Joseph Farris, just to quickly point out that corporate side, he made a point during his speech to say that EA were more than happy to let him do whatever he wants. And A Way Out is one of the most unique, original games going. I think and it's published by EA.
As like a segment, I think EA really are looking at themselves and trying to change things up. I think Anthem is the last thing they're going to do that's like, hey, we're going to want loads of money, we're going to try and replicate Destiny. But I think from here it's quite weird to think, because obviously EA was like the worst company in the universe for like 10 years.
Yeah.
Now I think they genuinely are trying to change things up, and I think that's great. So.
I mean, it's about time that they sort of... I mean, the thing is, like, if you dissect all the stuff, the report that Kotaku did on the realities of BioWare making Anthem, like, EA were mostly hands-off with it. A lot of that game's problems came kind of from BioWare, but there are apparently internal emails that Kotaku followed up reporting on saying that they are going to change a lot of
I don't think they can avoid changing, because the backlash this time around in particular has been so widespread.
Way too public,
And also, more than most other industries, the game community is very mobilised against these sort of issues. You know, it's very difficult to get mass markets to boycott movies and things like that, but when it comes to games, people tend to care more.
Good sir. So like I said, the other side of that coin is that A Way Out won Best Multiplayer, which has been a really good talking point, because it's how much do we put the idea of competitiveness into the term multiplayer? Because I love Way Out, so I was really happy that won. But you were saying, like, Richie,
in our last podcast we did about the BAFTAs and when we did all the nominations, we were discussing like the difference between multiplayer and co-op, because when it's more just based in like how the industry's gone in terms of multiplayer over the last 10 years. When you think of multiplayer, you think of competitive, not so much cooperative. And there's not enough out there to give a cooperative like award for solely cooperative. So I think that's probably why A Way Out won it, because it was something genuinely cooperative from the ground up. Because normally in the 360 era, a cooperative thing was normally just, here's the campaign, but someone else can load it. Like you could do in Halo, like you could do in World at
right,
War.
Yeah.
But I think Way Out would deserve it in that respect. But yeah, I was expecting it to go, as I said in the last podcast, I was expecting it to go to a competitive game, not a co-op game. Mm-hmm.
Good sir.
I was just going to say, there are so few cooperative games out there, which is why we even have this delineation in the first place.
True.
Just so people know in advance, I can almost name only like maybe five or so.
It's strange, because even in A Way Out's case, like, it's kind of on its own little island. Like, it is by definition co-op. You can't play that solo. You have to play with someone else. And like you were saying before we came in, like Benji, that like it promotes, you know, local co-op as well.
Yep.
Like, the best way to play that game is to find someone you love and play through it side by side.
Yeah.
Because there are a bunch of moments in that where you have to work together and you have to have, you know, different things happen in that dynamic.
Or very recent examples, maybe like Overcooked, for example. But even that can be played on its own. Mm-hmm. So it's not strictly multiplayer.
Yeah,
I think
true.
That's what is particularly interesting about it.
I did love at the very beginning Dara O'Brien mentioning Overcooked. Every time he mentioned an indie game, I was like, he actually plays that.
Yeah.
Like, mentioning Minute as well and Celeste and stuff was great. So another category, I mean, we can pick and choose random categories, but I think music was really good, just because the amount of the nominations for that category were just phenomenal. Like, yeah, Celeste is brilliant.
I'd say of all categories, it's definitely the most subjective. Because you can't really judge some like music's technical mastery.
Yeah, yeah.
In the same way, I really, really like the God of War soundtrack. Some of the effort that went in Hubert McCreary, just some incredible decisions. I'll just speak about him. He actually hired an Icelandic choir.
Cool.
on the basis that Icelandic is closest extant language related to Old Norse.
Right.
So unlike most like traditional choirs, it gave a really different sound. Mm. I think he also had a Faroese soprano called Ivar Palladóttir.
Okay.
Which again, singing in that language gives it such a different tone.
Yeah. I just think that
to most epic action soundtracks.
Yeah, because it's nearest analog when you first hear the main theme on the main menu and stuff is like Elder Scrolls. Like you sort of hear that that chanting and stuff.
It's Celtic.
There's more to it,
but it's different.
Mm-hmm. I just think it's just such a powerful
piece. I actually think,
piece.
Speaking of a way out there, I actually think it's more similar to the soundtrack of Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons.
Oh, cool.
Which is also similar,
kind of
thematically similar.
Noting.
I thought they were all really good selections. Lena Raine's soundtrack for Celeste,
brilliant. Thing, that main little melody just gets me. I think it's because I associate with the struggles of that game. So
yeah, and also Gris, which was composed by.
Do we have a final say on whether it's Gris?
I'm pretty sure it's Gris.
We're gonna go
Gris. I would have said it's Gris.
We'll go with Gris
just by the wording, by the spelling of it.
Cool. We'll go with Gris.
I'm happy to be corrected on that.
Even in the awards ceremony, they sell a couple of different versions of it. So,
But yeah, a really meditative soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Really like when I think of a game soundtrack, what makes a great game soundtrack isn't about how does it sound isolated. It's how well does it fit in with the game, does it achieve what it's supposed to? Which is why something like Rayman Origins, which I think the soundtrack is extremely frustrating at times, but it's absolutely perfect. It's flawless.
Yeah,
and the same applies to like Persona 5.
Persona 5 is great. That does have character away from the game.
That
too.
Couldn't exist in any other game, and that game couldn't exist without that soundtrack. Mm. That's the really important thing, and I think that applies to all these games. To be fair,
true.
It's such a very high bar.
I guess they're trying to find something where the score kind of exemplifies the feel, the soul, the passion of that project. Like comes through in the audio side as well. But they
if you're going to put it that way, there was only one winner of that.
Oh, you're back with your Tetris again. Yeah. Tetris was nominated.
I mean, Tetris was nominated, and I've got to give you that. I gushed about it in the last podcast.
Yes.
It's incredible soundtrack.
Go play Tetris.
In the same way that you were saying about like how well it exemplifies everything else, I think there's also the extent of going back to it after time, and it's not annoying, but it still works every single time. Like I have played through that game so many times. There's one level where at the end I keep playing through over and over and over again, and the song never ever gets old for me. Mm. Whereas as we always say when we talk about soundtrack in last year's games, we talk about Spider-Man and how it's like that was perfect.
Yeah.
But it didn't really do much else outside of that.
It's very much another Danny Elfman score.
And it's like, every time it happened, the same music came in, and it's like, it's fine. It doesn't really do much else. But I think, Tetris was my call for that.
Yeah,
but
I think as an addendum thing, go play Tetris Effect, go play Tetris 99. More people need to play Tetris.
Just go back to Tetris. It's like how suddenly Minecraft is cool again. Tetris is also cool.
It's also stunning. 30 years ago that a Tetris game has been nominated for a BAFTA.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the thing. Incredible.
That's the thing. Like, as me and Scott have been saying, like everyone just assumes, it's Tetris, who cares? It's like, yeah, but go play it.
Then
tell me that.
Mm-hmm. It's like the ultimate testament to Alexei Pachinov's original design that it's still relevant.
It's a weirdly emotional experience.
Yeah.
Like you get to the end of it and you hit the credits and you're sort of there like, oh God, I've just been playing an hour of Tetris. Why am I crying?
I know. It's brilliant. I mean, yeah, you'll get it if you play it. So we can kind of pick and choose stuff. I've got down Artistic Achievement, which Return of the Obra Dinn won, but that was up against Gris, God of War, Detroit, Red Dead Redemption 2, and Spidey. And I think that's just an interesting category to pick apart because on the one hand, you've got Detroit there, which is assumedly nominated because it's just on a pure power rendering level, that game looks amazing. But then if you go down, art direction and, the more artistically minded sort of, like pretentiously minded type stuff, then it's like, well, something like Obra Dinn stands out because it's never been done before.
I think artistic is more of a broad award. Like you could give it to, I would say you could give it to something like Detroit because of the fact that obviously your decision making, you got the branching narrative, obviously, obviously Obra Dinn won because of how absolutely stunning
that game is.
It's
like visual versus
God of War,
Red Dead 2, Spidey.
Yeah, Red Dead 2 again because of the scale, Gris because of obviously the visual style, like we're doing because of the visual style. I think it's quite an open award.
I personally see it as an award in terms of pure aesthetics. And again, you're saying there's God of War and Red Dead and Detroit powerhouses, aren't they? That's really what you're assessing. You're assessing how many artists came together and, I mean, brilliant achievements.
Yeah.
But I actually think in terms of style, Obra Dinn was the deserving winner.
It definitely stands out the most. Like you could look at any
did that narrative, did that game necessarily require a style that mimics a, like a one bit monochromatic Apple II
you could have easily done it in the style of Sea of Thieves or Skull and Bones and done the exact same thing.
So perhaps maybe it wasn't the most appropriate choice from Lucasfilm, but it came off so well.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to
actually don't
argue,
I've not dealt, like, I absolutely love Lucas Pope stuff. If you haven't played Papers, Please, like, check that out as well. But I haven't actually looked into interviews with Pope as to why he went with that exact specific style, because it is, it's very connotative of, like, what, like, early 80s?
Yeah.
Or whatever time.
It's Game Boy. It's Game Boy because it's green and it's green and dark green. It's very much an original Game Boy kinda, sort of colour scheme.
But also,
well, the Game Boy Color scheme was a 4-bit, I think, and this is 1-bit. So if this is like the PCs that you'll have been playing in the mid-80s. Yeah.
You can kind of tell it looks like a dot matrix printer. It's like a really old
school. It actually wasn't as simple as just applying a filter, because he was finding that originally how he did it, it was causing a lot of motion sickness moving around with a lot of the differing effects, like moving very quickly at today's frame rates. Mm-hmm. Obviously, when it's still images on an Apple II computer, it's not a problem. But so, you know, you actually have to put a lot of work into getting that.
That's one of the things as well, is like when you first start playing Obradin, or maybe you've seen screenshots and stuff of it, when you actually see it in motion when you're controlling it, it's the weirdest sensation, because you are controlling like an old piece of printer paper, which I guess is what he's going for, because it's all this, like, you're trying to piece together this story. It's remnants of memories and bits of evidence and stuff. So there are different pieces like that. I don't think we've missed out anything massive. Have a quick check of your list, good Sir Benjamin.
I was just thinking about the disconnect between the two mobile awards.
Yes.
We had the Best Mobile Award, which was voted for by the BAFTA panel, and it was also the EE Mobile Award.
Yeah,
which was voted for,
and the regular people.
And they actually get a mock BAFTA statue that's just yellow rather than gold, which feels like a bit of a kick in the teeth.
It's kind of like the EE Rising Star Award at the film BAFTAs as well. Yeah.
So really, that was more of a popularity contest. That one was won by Old School RuneScape,
which is great.
I thought it was really
assume it'd be Fortnite. It's like best ongoing game got Fortnite, and it's like
well, whatever. The other nominees for that were Fortnite and Pokemon Go. Mm-hmm. You know, the ones that everyone's playing.
Stuff that you assume that everyone's
whereas
playing.
Whereas the best mobile game went to Florence.
Yes,
which
Florence is phenomenal.
A 30-minute narrative about.
It's a relationship in a city.
Yeah, two people meeting first time and going off.
Again,
I
think it's down to like mobile game being the new mobile games, hence why it's on the BAFTA panel, and then the ongoing mobile game is the audience award. Because, I mean, who better to decide what game still ongoing is going to be worthy of award of the people that are playing it. So.
It's just like, because another point as well is like, if you differentiate those two like selections of games, like, you know, the ones that were voted for by the people are the ones that dominate the storefronts, and the ones that, you know, you're more likely to get a friendly recommendation about, or like you'll see an advert for or something, like a Fortnite. But then the best game on a mobile platform is something that the critics have sought out, or, you know, has sort of had a bit more, had its reputation built in different ways. Like something like Florence, I don't think I would even have noticed unless I don't think when I first noticed that. It was just somewhere in the run up to this. But Florence the appeal of Florence is completely different to something like, you know, a drop-in loot shooter.
And it's definitely not a mass appeal. It's not going to win a popular award.
Even though I think everyone should try it.
Absolutely, but unfortunately everyone won't. Mm-hmm. For a couple of other really interesting takeaways from this, Nintendo, despite the brilliant debut year they had with the Switch, with Breath of the Wild was sweeping awards last year.
Yes.
Only the Labo really did anything of note at this year's award.
I think what it did do is Lush. I absolutely love Nintendo Labo, but I think, it won Best Innovation, which is like, when you see the way that thing works, if you go hands-on with it and you faff around with the coding side of it, once you've built all your stupid pianos and your fishing rods, and then you go into the Toy-Con garage and you can remap all the different things and be like, okay, this light sensor makes this vibrate, or this makes this sound happen, or whatever, and your mind just kind of blows up, and you're like, oh my god, I can make like a shooting gallery, I can make this toy car move, or whatever, and like, you know, one of the examples they showed off in the showreel was someone had made like a drum set based on when the Joy-Cons feel a vibration, they make a drum noise. And it's like, just thinking of that is so innovative and so, you know, for children or whatever, anybody really, is just
it also won best amazing. Family game as well.
Yes.
Which is ridiculous, because I think we assumed it might be something like Super Mario Party, but Labo, it just everything makes sense with it. It's fantastic.
I mean, it's interesting you say about Super Mario Party. I hope that was nominated for best multiplayer game.
As well, Smash as well.
Yeah, but other than when it came to first party Nintendo games, almost no representation at the awards at all, and no wins.
Yeah.
And it's just, that's interesting coming from a first party hardware manufacturer, that they haven't really came up with anything in the last 12 months.
I mean, things like, just realizing that Pokemon Let's Go, was that nominated for
that
anything?
Was them, but that did not get nominated for much. Yeah. Well, Pokemon Go did, but
Pokemon
not Let's
Go did,
Go, like,
but that's not Nintendo.
No.
So.
Yeah, but it was a bit of a weird thing in terms of, like, I guess Japanese representation of the games that they're offering, but then you look at Nintendo's catalogue and they have kind of taken a step back. They've had a whole snafu with Prime's release date, Animal Crossing. Kind of looks like it was announced way ahead of when it had anything worth showing.
I mean, as well as Metroid Prime 4, let's face it. Irrelevant of the fact they were having to start again. Like, totally. They still just said, it's in development. It's like Bethesda with Elder Scrolls and Starfield.
In 2 years.
And it's kind of think that their sort of motion going into this year was very much like just bear with us. You know, it was just like bear with us. We've got irons in the fire. Just we'll keep going. Yeah. But there is that sort of conversation around whether they had too much momentum at the beginning and they, you know, like put everything out too fast, kind of thing. Another massive talking point though we can sort of pivot into is because of Sekiro being on the market and, you know, like From Software's new game being ludicrously hard. There's a massive conversation around the idea of difficulty versus accessibility and all those conversations that come out of that, which I personally think is just incredibly fascinating to pick apart.
Yeah.
And so one of the biggest things with this is that a lot of the opinion pieces online tend to get it wrong, tend to conflate the wrong things.
Precisely that. The conflation becomes between the general definition of the word accessible and the specific meaning of accessibility within the strata of video games. They're not the same thing.
No.
They're two different questions, and I really think it's quite dangerous if we start talking about people being able to beat games because they're too hard, rather than people not being able to beat games because they're either physically or cognitively impaired. Mm-hmm. Like, and people saying, well, Sekiro should be easy because I've bought it and I can't finish it. Well, that's not really
if you're an
able-bodied
person, then you have, you know, you can have another go.
It's not about making games easier because people don't have the time to practice. Mm-hmm. It's about making games possible for people to play who, no matter what sort of practice they put in or what commitment they put in, could never possibly reach that level because of, like I say, certain impairments.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yeah, well, one of the biggest things, I mean, they mentioned it in the BAFTA Awards. I forget which person was accepting their award, and I had like a quick little aside to just say, can we just get a round of applause for the adaptive controller that like Microsoft have put out there?
Yeah, well,
it's a great thing.
But what I will mention is it was retailing for £73.50.
Yeah.
And that's just for the base unit.
Yeah, which is twice as much as a regular controller. Now, I can understand that the manufacturing costs might be higher.
Apparently the R&D did go on for a while, yeah.
Yeah.
But obviously,
but at the same time, that is just a sacrifice that a company the size of Microsoft should be prepared to make.
Of course.
Now, I don't want to criticize them because they have actually came out and made this product. Mm-hmm. But it would be nice to see a concession given.
No, absolutely. There should be price parity.
There shouldn't be a premium for accessibility, irrelevant to production costs.
Exactly.
But it's like just as the wider thing in terms of Sekiro, a great thing was Matt Thorson, who's the developer on Celeste. He actually put out, because Celeste has an assist mode. And if you played through Celeste, like just its main sort of difficulty, it is quite a challenging game, especially if you're going to go after the collectibles.
Absolutely.
And there's an option in the main menu to turn on an assist mode, which changes your save file. And he was just saying that that's the kind of a way to address kind of both sides in terms of making a difficult game more accessible, which is, it's a very thorny kind of issue in terms of the gray area in the middle. Because I guess you don't want to make something like Sekiro. You don't want to reduce the artistic side of it, where like if someone made a game
and they want
it to be brutally hard.
This is the complaint I keep hearing is, why can't Sekiro just be hard? We like it to be hard.
Right.
Well, if there is an accessibility mode or an assist mode that helps people enjoy the game who otherwise wouldn't be able to, I do not understand what the big problem with that is.
No, well, that's like, the kind of conversation.
It does not undermine your achievement at putting all those hours of grinding. Because for some people, playing in an assisted mode, presents just as hard a challenge as playing in the regular mode.
Yeah.
and overcoming that for them is, it could be a brilliant achievement, and why, I don't know why that is a bad thing.
No, not at all. I mean, that's the thing. Like, the stuff that Matt Thorsten put forward is the best way to appeal to that crowd. That,
well, I think Celeste's assist mode is absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
It's not patronising. It doesn't ruin the game in any way. It's there if you need it. It's optional.
Yeah, because some games, like, I mean, on a pure difficulty level side, like, sometimes you'll die in something and it'll pop up and say, do you want to switch to easy mode? Devil May Cry 5 does that. And I'm just like, I don't need the reminder. Yeah, I'll keep
Fallout,
going.
Not Fallout. Was it God of War that does that as well? Oh, it's Resident Evil. Resident Evil 2.
Yes.
Does that as well, the remake. Mm-hmm. But it's like, I can kind of see where people are coming from. I think there's an essence of, like, an echo of games becoming more accessible, not in terms of accessibility, in terms of, like, its difficulty and obviously for people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. I think it's more making games more accessible to open it up to a broader audience. And I think that's what people are kind of concerned about, and they are misconstruing the two same things.
Exactly.
When you take something like Fallout 4, for example, that watered a lot of stuff down, and I will admit, it got me massively into Fallout because I could never get into New Vegas and 3, but that got me into it. And I think people are worried that that's going to degrade their game. Yeah, but as you said, if it's just a toggle switch, that's perfect.
You can understand why that's a dangerous area, though, because when people start complaining about games being watered down for the sake of accessibility, suddenly people start saying, well, we don't want accessible games, and that's not what we want to be saying.
Yeah, I mean, the way that Thorsten put it across is that, like, if that's the point I was going to make with the some games incentivize you to go and switch over. Like, there's no incentivization in Celeste to go, like, oh, hey, maybe you should switch to the other mode. I mean, it does do a pop-up eventually.
I think if you die numerous times in the same place, like, towards the end of the game, and you're getting killed by a boss over and over again, it will prompt. And I do understand how patronizing that does come across, because I'm always there, like, I don't want to play at the lower mode. I'd rather push myself.
The big solution to this as well, and when it doesn't come to difficulty, is to be upfront about these assist modes. Mm-hmm. Let people know in advance if it's going to be a challenge in certain ways, and if you need extra help, then it's available. That's a really great way of handling it.
Because I think the thing to your point, Rich, about, like, the I always go down, like, the road of, like, you know, like, you know, you protect the creators, you protect the artistic vision of something, which I think you can absolutely do. But then it's just like, it's like, how much of a game has to be changed in terms of the difficulty of it? But that's not necessarily the conversation. It's more you want to make it so that everybody has an equal chance to fail if you take it to the Sekiro.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, an equal chance to fail.
Yeah,
so it's just a difficult game for everybody. But in with various gradations.
Yeah, but you don't necessarily want, like, well, I don't necessarily want the you know, a level design to completely change. If the creator just wanted to make a rough level, but
somebody on Twitter posted, like, this is my idea for an accessibility mode in Sekiro, and I think it might have been and he's like, oh, there's no stagger, like, you've always got unlimited posture, whatever, stuff like that. I think that's I think it would just be a case of, like, tweaking how your character or whatever will move and interact with the world, but the world doesn't actually change.
Right.
It's like making you know, enemies have less health, or I think you were mentioned Spider-Man PS4 has got an option to turn off the quick time events or the, like, button mashing stuff.
Yeah, well,
so for people who can't, like, do button mashing because of whatever, then they can still do that. They can still play through the game. I think that is something that I think it's a great thing to do, and there's a part of me that thinks it should be a thing that needs to be done.
That stuff, I would say, should be mandatory.
And, like, I understand the idea of Sekiro, want, like, the artistic vision of being like, this is what Sekiro is. Admittedly, you're buying a From Software game directed by Hidetaka Miyazaki. It's gonna be hard. And if you're gonna completely put that aside and then whinge about it, then you are just kind of being an idiot. Mm-hmm. But I do understand the appeal, and I think the necessity for an assist mode, be it if it just changes a couple of things, like just adds to the infinite posture, just changes that. It's like New Super Mario Bros. U, when they released that on the Switch, as much as it is an absolute waste of money, they added in Nabbit, who doesn't get damaged by anything. And you think, but that sounds really dumb.
Nintendo, you talk about creative visions, and theirs is as pure as anyone's, but they've been putting assist modes in all their games for about 10 years now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like Mario Kart 8 Deluxe has got the automatic steering and things like that, which is great when you give your 3-year-old nephew a controller and let him go nuts so he can start actually play.
I've read testimonies of people who are impaired in terms, I think an amputee mentioned that she couldn't play the game without the auto steering.
Yeah, yeah.
Because obviously she couldn't use the other hand. So, like, that's a brilliant thing.
Well, I have, like, a personal friend who, like, just literally struggles to hold the Xbox controller. And so he was saying, like, one of the best things about the adaptive controller, like, it's obviously going to be that you can remap the buttons, and it's just it's
easier to hold.
Well,
that's one of the most basic things, being having the option to remap buttons on a game, which there's a list of really basic things that so many games don't actually achieve when it comes to accessibility.
Yeah, when Xbox said we're doing the adaptive controller, and it was like, of course. Like, why has this not been done across the board? Like, Nintendo don't have anything like this.
Nor does Sony.
No, like, you know, like, the actual physical hardware that you're controlling, that should be changed across the board.
It kind of of annoying. I mean, I don't know whether the Xbox adaptive controller has Bluetooth capabilities like the One S controller onwards do. In that case, then they're the kind of things you can use with other consoles, yes, with just a bit of tweaking.
Well, also you mentioned Nintendo. The Switch is the most versatile console out there, and yet
it doesn't have
a single-handed mode. True. I've seen people make custom versions.
Same,
of it.
Yeah.
I'm honestly surprised we haven't got like for example, Amazon Fire tablets. You can buy them like dirt cheap, and they make ones for kids. They've got kids tablets. I'm really surprised we haven't got like kid-proof Joy-Cons and things like that, and then just, you know, because as you said, it's so versatile. It's really surprising they haven't made basically like a bigger Joy-Con, like an adaptive controller sized Joy-Con.
With the Switch, inadvertently, is already very accessible for people who are visually impaired. Because I know with the 3DS, no, my vision's, I'm not visually impaired, but it's quite bad.
Right. Yeah.
But I know it's over time. Just with like natural macular degeneration, I was struggling to see the screen. Mm-hmm. With the Switch, we found made a hybrid console that can both be used handheld and on a screen. So going forward, people who really do struggle to see a tiny screen, well, they've got an option.
Yeah.
But that wasn't intended. That was just...
No, that was something they sort of just stumbled into. Whereas like something like Dead Rising in 2006 like had tiny text you played on an HDTV and then you could maybe read it.
That was
just things like GUI scale. They should have to everything.
Yeah. Yes.
What was the name again?
Dead Rising?
Dead Rising, that's it. The issue there was that it was during the changeover between standard definition and HD, and so it was maybe a thing for developers didn't know.
No, yeah.
But there are far, far too many games out there that don't provide adequate subtitles. They have The Witcher 3, I mentioned, I really struggled to enjoy that because I couldn't read any of the flavor text.
Right. They do have a big HUD mode now. They didn't back when you first played it.
I think it went up to something like 115%.
Right.
Well, I really needed about 200%.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There's no standardized way of having subtitles in most games. You get some of that right across the screen. Mm-hmm. You get some of that tiny. You get some of that blend in with the background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some that do everything. Going back to Valve games, they have a fantastic subtitle system.
Because not only do they have clearly readable subtitles that like correspond with what you'd consider like a film standard or a television standard, but they also have written audio cues.
Yep. Which I used to use it all the time to kind of like half cheat my way through Half-Life 2, and it's like it says head crab noise. It's like there's one around the corner.
It's interesting you say the word you use there, cheat, right?
Yeah.
For you, it is a cheat, and some people say, well, that's ruined.
For other people, that's an accessibility
option. Absolutely mandatory, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of like wraps back around to the potential side I was getting at before about in defending a creative vision. Like, I think that Celeste's message, its core message about overcoming anxiety, depression, adversity, whatever, is the most worthwhile message in gaming I've personally ever experienced, and I adore it for that. And so I think that one of the reasons they have the assist mode in there is because they want that message to get out to as many people as possible. That's an artistic choice, and it makes sense to have an assist mode in there outside of the controller you're using to play it. But also, like, you know, if you're from software and they want to pride themselves on making a game that only a handful of people can get through, then it is that thing where the game's, the artistic side of it stays solid, but the way that you, the barrier for entry should be lowered considerably, like I said before.
Yep.
So everybody is allowed to fail equally.
Yep.
That's where I kind of come down on it.
I think, but boy, when you boil it down, I think there's an idea that you can have accessibility features, as we've discussed about, you could do X, Y, and Z with whatever, but they won't detract from the game unless you switch them on.
Which is a great, one of Thorsten's points was that all the things he suggested for the assist mode would just be on a separate save. And it's just like...
Just flick a switch and there you go.
Yeah, and it's just like you remove that sort of incentivization.
And also, the other thing as well is, I know some people have been suggesting, well, maybe you shouldn't get achievements or maybe you shouldn't get trophies.
Right.
I don't think you should have punitive measures.
You're playing on like if you're playing a game that has like super duper easy mode, or you've got things that can tweak gameplay like on the fly, not necessarily, maybe for accessibility, but maybe it's just to muck about in the same way, like you put a cheat into GTA 5 and it goes, well, you can't get any achievements now. Or you do.
Well, like in Cuphead, you can't progress past the aisle until you put it on the normal difficulty.
Well, you can beat all the bosses on simple to use it as like that, like
that's
sort of a step up and then go, okay, now we know what to do. Let's get the third phase in, and then you go from there. But yeah, I can honestly see that as well. And yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like if they're going to switch on achievements and stuff for the easier difficulties to make it more accessible, it's like, I don't see why people would complain about that.
I think you just have separate achievements to say, like, beat the game. I mean, they have them anyway.
But it's like, you look at Call of Duty or Halo, they always said, you know, you've done this, but you've beaten it on Veteran, or you've beaten it on Legendary.
I think it's, at this stage, obviously, it's an ongoing conversation, but I like the idea that, you know, it's
also their mention, Rich, it's you say about Veteran and Legendary. So even when it comes to naming difficulties, don't Don't mock the player.
I mean, to use an easy mock. Wolfenstein, get away with it. I think, you know, like, please don't hurt me, daddy. And stuff like that.
Very tongue in cheek.
And then I think my favorite difficulty levels that I've seen is in God of War. Right. When it's like, give me story, give me gameplay, give me God of War.
That's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah.
Because what you're saying there with Wolfenstein, that's actually about difficulty. It's not about accessibility.
True. Yes.
So, but if your accessible mode is called easy mode,
You've already defeated the purpose.
They just call it accessibility mode. Yeah. That's literally it.
Yeah. Or like you said, story, classic, and things like that. Those are good terms as well. Mm-hmm. If you're just wanting to play, experience the game,
it's like playing God of War. Like I wanted to put it on normal because I wanted to get the whole experience of playing it. But it's like there was a part of me when I was on that screen thinking, I would just really like to sit and watch a game.
Yeah,
like,
and that's a choice. Obviously, we are like very able and easy to make, but
but not everyone has that.
Yeah, exactly. I'd also say normal is a really really bad word.
I'm not a fan of that. Yeah, I think there's a whole bunch of stuff. It's obviously a massive
standard default, something like that.
Yeah, but no, but that's standard doesn't sound
because it's like
either.
Saying
yeah.
like oh the thing that I'm capable of if it's lower than normal or what is am I not normal for playing on this mode, like, you know, there's all that. And so it is a humongous conversation. I think that it's fascinating to pick apart.
It's really worthy. I'm really glad it's come far because it's something that not a lot of people necessarily have cared about a lot, and it's something that maybe some companies haven't even cared
about.
Well,
just seeing the Xbox controller kind of opened my eyes as to, like, why is this not everywhere? Like, and I said, my friend, like, he, you know, back when Assassin's Creed 2 came out, he was saying he was struggling with just the general being able to get up on rooftops and you know, kill dudes and the different buttons you needed to use just because of the way that he was holding the pad. And that was one of the things where, you know, you just, at the time, you're just sort of like, oh, that sucks, man, like, whatever. But the conversation just wasn't happening back then. Whereas now it's just ongoing and hopefully it'll lead to
great things. I know we mentioned the EA in passing earlier about some of their practices, but I think they are one of the companies who do hire as many differently abled playtesters as possible to try and make their games as adaptable as possible. Mm-hmm. And I know it's maybe not practical with small independent studios, although you tend to find those are some of the ones who care about it the most.
But it is
something all the major companies
maybe that's something that could be done as a separate thing. There will be like an accessibility authority that are a third party that devs and publishers can send their games to as like a separate QA.
Sometimes it's a lack of knowledge as well. It's not a lack of desire. It's just some developers don't know what they're supposed to do. An advisory body would be
because then you could literally say like this game has been like approved by the accessibility authority.
Yeah, that'd be fantastic.
For example.
I think
you get that stamp and like anybody can go, yeah, I can play that. Yeah. I think that'd be great.
I think these conversations lead to things like that. Like I said, it's an ongoing thing. It's weird because in that you said like an external body or a mandated thing. Xbox used to mandate on the Xbox Live Store that every game have a demo. They used to mandate that.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you're going to mandate something like that, then maybe on the console side you can begin to mandate accessibility options across the board, you know, like assist options or whatever. There's definitely things like colorblind mode, subtitle size, whatever. Those are like entry level things.
Quite a lot of hardware do have those options, but sometimes they don't go far enough because they can't. Mm-hmm. You know, like there's only so much you can add. Like you can add a zoom function on the PlayStation, but you can't correct the colors of a game with hardware.
Mm-hmm. I think the only thing that, in terms of on the creative side, is if someone wants to just make an incredibly hard game that only a fraction of the populace can get through, I think they're allowed to obviously do that.
They're allowed to do it, but everybody should have the opportunity to try.
Yes, that's the crux, I think.
Yeah, it's not. This is not about you're making Sekiro easy, you're making Dark Souls easy. It's not about making it easy.
No.
I don't understand why people keep getting confused.
I just think because the most reactionary easy take is you're changing my game.
It would make it easier for some people if they chose to use that mod.
It's choice.
I think that's always the thing. It's a completely optional thing, and people who get a whinge about it, it's like, but you don't have to use it. Mm-hmm. So nothing to do with you. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, and I played Celeste on its standard mode. I didn't turn the assist mode on, and it was one of the most powerful experiences that I've ever played in gaming.
Yeah.
And that game has an assist mode, but I like, you know, because of the situation that I'm in, I can play on the mode that it had, kind of thing, and it still totally works.
Sometimes this opinion's coming from a position of privilege.
Yes.
That we don't necessarily...
Which we all, you know, where we have an able-bodied privilege, like, totally.
Yeah, completely. So, that's probably one of the reasons why it hasn't been discussed much until now, and as soon as people have something that they can complain about, I don't want an easy Sekiro, then it's actually came
up
far.
This is up to this point, I've always seen it, like, the people who aren't able-bodied have always just sort of tried to make do. Like, you know, I've had a friend
you
who...
You either struggle or you can't do it.
Yeah, like, I had a friend who had, like, some like twisted bones from birth or something, and like he could still play with a DualShock 3 just perfectly fine. It was actually quite incredible watching him do it. And there's a video of a guy when Apex Legends came out. I don't think he's got any arms,
right?
But he got his first win on Twitch using like his feet.
Right.
And it's incredible. And
there's
it's
some incredible feats.
Yeah.
Like, yeah,
but then it's like, yeah, now that that conversation has come up again, and it means like, okay, you know, you've been trying your best to make it like with what you can get, but now we can make it, then you can make it what you
need.
I think
that really puts it in a perspective that it's definitely not an easy mod, is it?
No.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. And it shouldn't be like one-offs where someone's managed to create this feat of getting over the horrific.
I know there was a terrific story about Abe's Exodus on the PlayStation 1, the sound design that was so brilliant. But I believe it was a blind game was able to complete from start to finish using just the audio cues.
That's incredible.
And I mean, that's a testament to a fantastic sound design.
Yeah.
I think, like I said, it's an ongoing thing. We've managed to cover, I don't know, 20 minutes like it was 2 seconds. But yeah, you guys can all find us on social media. We're over on the Twitters and all that type jazz. Just search What Culture Gaming, or you can find Rich, myself, Scott, or Benjamin. We're all over there on the Twitters. But for now, this has been the What Culture Gaming podcast. I hope you guys all have enjoyed it, and we'll catch you next time. I've been Scott. That's not even how I usually do the sign up. I have been Scott, though. Joined by Benjamin Richardson.
Goodbye.
Enjoy by Richardson.
Thank you for listening.
We'll catch you next time.
Bye. Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.